This is an ABC podcast.
Talofa ulufale mai. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Coming to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation, I would like to pay respects to their elders past and present. Coming up on the show, outgoing head of Melanesian Spearhead Group passes on the baton to Fiji.
The MSG is not defined by the size of our population or the scale of our economies, but by the depth of our cultural cohesion, the integrity of our intentions and the richness of our collective wisdom.
Guam used as a decoy in recent US attacks on Iran, but could they too become targets?
Once there's an area where democracy and freedom is compromised and threatened, if that spills over to the Pacific, then of course we are going to be here prepared for the defense of Guam.
And Indonesia's Papua province, Raja Ampat, has been described as paradise on earth, but it's been trending online for all the wrong reasons. So stay tuned for that and more. Toku ingoa ko egi. I say fafitai lasi. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We start in Guam, where Governor Lou Leon Guerrero has assured residents they are safe after the island was used as a decoy for the US launch attack on Iranian nuclear facilities. B-2 stealth bombers were deployed to Guam hours before the strike as part of a deliberate attempt to deceive onlookers. The deception put Guam at the centre of international headlines, and as Whenau Whenua reports, it's worrying residents that they too could become targets.
In these pictures from Isfahan, you can see and hear the airstrikes hitting one of the three nuclear sites attacked. Iran obviously knew this was a possibility, but may not have been expecting...
The attack by the United States on nuclear sites in Iran is the latest in a dramatic chain of events in the Middle East that has captivated the world over the last 2 weeks. Guam played a key role in the operation, with the U.S. military command using the territory as a decoy. B-2 stealth bombers were deployed to the island to create the impression that it would be the launching site for a strike. The potential threat of retaliation, however, has sparked public anxiety.
I'm reassuring our people that we are safe.
Guam's Governor Lou Leon Guerrero released a message soon after the strike reassuring the public. She says there's no credible threat posed by Iran to the island.
Yes, the military has increased their level of force protection. They went from Alpha to Bravo, and so they're tightening up their security in the bases. But as far as our community, we continue on with our daily business. There is no specific immediate threats now. I don't believe there's fiscal threats here. We continue to say that our island is safe.
Guam has been an outpost for U.S. military operations, most notably during the Vietnam War and World War II. The territory produces a high per capita of troops for the U.S. military, but perhaps most significant of all has been the territory's consistent support of the U.S. government in its foreign conflicts.
We have a very strong partnership and relationship with the U.S. We have a very strong relationship with the federal government of the United States and also the military. And that's because of our history of being a U.S. territory since 1898 after the Spanish-American War. So that's where we stand politically, and that's where we stand in terms of U.S. relationship and U.S. engagement in the whole Pacific deterrence program here in this part of the world. Certainly, you know, world politics, global politics, once there's an area where democracy and freedom is compromised and threatened, if that then spills over to the Pacific, then of course we are going to be here prepared for the defense of Guam.
The governor of the U.S. territory of Northern Marianas, Arnold Palacios, also released a statement following the strikes. Local journalist Mark Rabago says Governor Palacios was more diplomatic in his wording.
He just said the CNMI, which is the Northern Marianas, remains alert and remain positively hopeful and confident that peace and diplomacy reign for the benefit of the U.S. citizens and the fellow brethren here and around the world.
Like Guam, public opinion in the Northern Marianas consistently favors U.S. government foreign policy when it comes to conflict.
We have a skin in the game because some of our troops are in the military, in the U.S. military. So, and then we have bases here, or in Guam particularly, and the CNMI, which is north of Guam, hosts several training facilities or several training events for the military. The CNMI and Guam is part of the U.S.
But there is unease at the Pacific being a part of the chessboard in the U.S. strategy towards the Middle East. Tale Magnioni is a researcher with the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons.
They really risk widespread escalation and nuclear catastrophe.
Magnioni says the strikes, which Trump claims to have squashed Iran's alleged nuclear ambitions, are only fueling the dangers of nuclear proliferation.
You know, Israel is said to have over 90 nuclear warheads. The United States has over 1,000. And, you know, for the they say that they're attacking Iran because of their nuclear capability. And even so, you know, there hasn't been evidence necessarily that these will be used for nuclear arsenals. And we just think that overall, like, nuclear escalation affects everyone. And it really threatens, I guess, the norms that, you know, Pacific states have fought for in terms of being nuclear free.
And that was Magnioni Tale, a researcher at the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. For more on this story, we have on the line former Guam delegate to the United States House of Representatives and current chair of the Pacific Center for Island Security, Robert Underwood. With that, I say thank you, Mr. Underwood, for joining us here on Pacific Beat.
Well, thank you very much. Good morning.
Absolutely. Look, as we get into this, I mean, why do you think, Mr. Underwood, Guam was chosen by the U.S. military as a decoy for this attack?
Well, because everybody knows that Guam is a place from where you attack others. And so the idea that you could be a decoy without you knowing that you're a decoy only ratifies the military view of Guam and its primary purpose, which is basically to be a military facility from which U.S. power is projected, especially in this part of the world. I would say that in the past, Guam has been used as a military facility to bomb Iraq back in the 1990s. So it is not unusual for Guam to be used in that way, but it is an indicator that, Guam is seen not just by the military, but the entire world as nothing more than a military facility.
Mm. Well, and so when we look at the community, how do you think they reacted when, you know, Guam popped up in international headlines before the strike?
Well, obviously, initially, people, of course, are hoping that whatever military strike occurs successfully and does not do harm to Guam. But in the, in the past couple of days, of course, there have been many people that have come out and said, to what end is this effort done in Iran, and what implications does it have for Guam moving forward? Because there's a couple of things about this strike in the Iran which are sobering, because it is not, unlike many other military activities which the U.S. has engaged in the past few decades, there was no run-up. It wasn't a response to an attack. It was an attack in and of itself. And so does that mean that the U.S. now has adopted a first-strike policy? And if it has adopted a first-strike policy, what does that mean for a place like Guam, from which a first strike can be orchestrated? That's very frightening.
Mm. Well, and we know just recently Iran has since retaliated, right, by targeting U.S. bases in Qatar and Iraq. Does Iran then have the capability to target Guam if they so choose?
No, I don't think so. And of course, it would be the main situation that we continue to contend with Guam is the use of Guam by the military in the ongoing strategic competition with China. and how the entire U.S. response in this part of the world is almost entirely military. They're in economic competition with China. They're in diplomatic competition with China. They're in military competition with China. But if you live in Guam and Micronesia, the entire response is military. It's not diplomatic. It's not economic. It's entirely military. And so you understand your role to some extent when you lived on Guam, and it's heavily militarized since the end of World War II. But that causes you to think, well, what else? What other role can we play? If the attack had been orchestrated for Guam, then Guam would have been a partner in war, and maybe an unwilling partner, because unlike Japan or Korea or the Philippines or other independent nations in Asia, you know, the military can use Guam without telling the people of Guam, without telling the governor, without asking permission. They can just use it and they'll tell you later. So if that's the situation that we find ourselves in, and first strike options are now on the table, that, I think, puts us in a much more vulnerable position than has been in the past. And so in this situation, Guam is a partner in war, but it is not a partner in peace. It is not. Nobody is asking our opinion about what would make a more peaceful Pacific. We're only asked to play a role in a Pacific where there is conflict.
And that's the thing, Mr. Underwood. What lessons do you think then Guam can learn, you know, from all the fuss created by the U.S. strike on Iran?
Well, we'll see. The political leaders obviously will sort of line up behind it. I haven't heard any people in elected office saying otherwise. And then they might say that we can get benefits from it. But until Guam stands up and says, we will not continue to accept any and all military initiatives in Guam, there's no way to balance the relationship. I think most people in Guam, yes, they are generally favorable to the military, U.S. military. But on the other hand, there's a growing concern as to what are we getting out of it? Are we just a pawn? And how do we stand up? How do we assert ourselves in this relationship? And that's really the next step, is the assertion, the capacity to say no, the capacity to say, no, we're not going to accept everything you tell us, and we're not going to accept the scenario in which our only role is to attack others or be attacked.
Mr. Underwood, you know, your firm, the Pacific Center for Island Security, actually made a statement yesterday saying, you know, the use of Guam as a decoy was done without consultation from partners. So is that something that you would like to see change going forward?
Well, obviously, we would like the capacity to be able to be engaged in that decision-making, or at least consultation. But of course, none of that exists. So, you know, example, if the United States had decided to use military bases from Japan or Korea to make a strike, they would have to ask Japan and Korea for permission and engage in a series of consultations. In this case, well, you don't have to do that. So, you know, the relationship, it's a political relationship between Guam and the United States. Guam is an unincorporated territory. It is a separate entity. It is not fully represented in the U.S. government like a state. And so as a consequence of that, we are more powerless. We have less power, less influence than even a state like Hawaii in terms of military activity. So the next step has to be empowering Guam to gain a seat at the table.
Look, I just want to say thank you very much, Mr. Underwood, for joining us this morning. That is all the time that we have. But again, we appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
And apologies to our listeners. I know that connection may have been a little bit fuzzy, but we do appreciate you being patient with us and listening into this story. That was former Guam delegate to the United States House of Representatives Robert Underwood here on Pacific Beat.
Join Sose Fo'amoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent, mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Mea taki maata, welcome back to Pacific Beat. We go to the Cook Islands, where Parliament is set to vote on three proposed amendments to the Constitution. These include allowing non-parliamentarians to serve as government ministers, allow MPs to vote in Parliament via proxies, and increase the number of ministers in Cabinet. One of those casting his vote today will be Sholin Evaitzi, Vice President of the Cook Islands Democratic Party. He told the ABC's Johnson Rayla that although his party supports one of the amendments, the government will be searching for votes to get all its changes over the line.
Yeah, so the three amendments, Constitution Amendment Number 30, Bill 2023, there are two things within this bill to be voted on. The first one is to increase the number of cabinet ministers from 6 to 8, and the second one is to remove the ability to appoint a minister who is not a member of parliament. The second amendment is Constitutional Amendment Number 31, Bill 2023. And this basically enables Parliament to meet following a general election. So once an election's held, the work of Parliament can start, even though there are discrepancies or issues. And the final one is Constitutional Amendment Number 32, Bill 2023. So this bill is to amend the Constitution to enable members of Parliament to vote in the, by proxy. So they don't actually have to be present in Parliament. They can actually ask another member or MP to vote for them.
But what are your main concerns relating to these amendments?
I think one of them is increasing cabinet ministers from 6 to 8. I think the concerns, one, it's going to be costly. I think the average cabinet minister's office, I think their budget's roughly about 500,000. So if you multiply that by 3, you know, you're looking at a cost of potentially 1.5 mil or thereabouts. This is, I mean, the issue I have and I raise is the Prime Minister increasing the number of cabinet ministers because he has to appease some people who have had a falling out or haven't been remunerated. The Cook Islands is quite a small population, so and having a cabinet of 6, I think it's better than one of 8 because decisions can be made fairly quickly. So I guess you could say cabinet is more responsive. Quicker decision making. If you have more, that could potentially have issues, particularly if there's disagreement. It just creates more bureaucracy and it's inefficiency, in my view, and from my experience, having worked in government. And I guess another question comes really down to performance. Aren't the ministers performing well at 6, 8 is required, for example? Has a performance review been actually carried out to say, actually, 6 is not enough?
Furthermore, into that Article 13 amendment, the second part of it is the potential that non-elected people can become members of Parliament or ministers. If that goes ahead, you know, some people are asking, you know, what's the point of having a general election? Is that actually a valid statement?
I think it's probably been a misinterpretation of that. So what it actually is doing is actually removing the ability for cabinet to appoint someone outside that hasn't been voted in a general election to actually come into cabinet and become a minister. I mean, at the moment, you can actually go and get someone from outside and appoint them as a minister. So what this part of the bill is doing is removing that. And that's something that the Democratic Party supports, that you should be an elected member to become a cabinet minister, for example.
Now, the amendment to Article 34, what are your thoughts on being able to vote by proxy?
Well, my position is that you should be in Parliament. You are elected to represent people, and people expect you to be there to voice their concerns if there are any. It also creates a mess where someone could proxy vote because someone was sick but didn't have their permission, and et cetera, et cetera. Decisions are then made when this other person hadn't actually given their consent. People expect your member of parliament to represent them, so you should be present.
Does the government have the numbers to pass these amendments today?
So the current government has got 12. There are three independents who would normally support the government. There's three of them, so there's 15. You need a two-third majority to pass it under the to make a constitutional amendment. So you actually need 16. So the government is still one short. But we are aware of government coming to MPs and enticing them to change to support this. I mean, the Democratic position is quite clear. Those three amendments, you know, we don't support increasing cabinet ministers from 6 to 8. We do support the removal of the ability to get someone from outside to be a minister. You have to be elected to be in a cabinet minister. Proxy for us just causes so much issues, problems. It's better for your representative to be there, be in parliament. They get paid to do that, so they should be there. If it goes through, you know, it is going to cause issues going forward. Whilst government doesn't think so or believe so, I can definitely see that that's going to be the case.
And that's Vice President of the Cook Islands Democratic Party, Sholin Evaiti.
Pacific Beat.
Now, Melanesian solidarity was on full display in Fiji this week as Vanuatu handed over the chairmanship of the Melanesian Spearhead Group to Fiji. The ceremonial event held at the Great Council of Chiefs Complex blended Fijian and Ngāi Vanuatu traditions, a powerful reminder of shared cultural roots. The outgoing head of the MSG, Vanuatu Prime Minister Jotham Napat, described the handover of leadership to Fijian Prime Minister Sitiveni Rampoka as not as a simple exchange of leadership, but a sacred renewal, symbolising unity, identity and collective responsibility across Melanesia.
The MSG is not divine by the size of our population or the scale of our economies, but by the depth of our cultural cohesion, the integrity of our intentions, and the richness of our collective wisdom. The era ahead calls for bolder collaborations, smarter diplomacy, and an unwavering unity. Whether facing climate volatility, technological disruptions in supply chains, or global realignments, we must remain in solidarity as the Melanesian family.
But the summit was more than just a celebration of culture, as leaders gathered to discuss regional solidarity, institutional reform, climate change, self-determination and Pacific security. On the backdrop of conflict in the Middle East and the US strike on Iran, Jotham Napat, the outgoing chair, called for unity.
As the world moves through increasing complexity and the uncertainty ahead, the relevance of our group grows stronger, not weaker. In a time of shifting alliance, resources, rivalries, and global distractions, we must remain vigilant and united. We must continue to be architects of our own future, and not by bystanders to other nations' ambitions.
And that is outgoing Melanesian Spearhead Group Chair and Vanuatu PM Jotham Napat.
Hold the front page!
Nisan Bolivinak, and welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aki Tupong. Of course, we've got our producer in a studio, Carl Evans, who's going to give us our latest headlines from around the region. How are you doing?
Good morning, Aggie. I'm well. Happy Tuesday to you.
Yeah, I know. It's only Tuesday, but I do have to quickly ask, how did the basketball go?
because we did talk about it yesterday.
I'm sure a lot of people out in the Pacific watched it. Actually, it was actually very sad. I mean, it was a really good game, but unfortunately, the Pacers' best player, I think he tore his Achilles about 7 minutes into the match in what was a really tragic turn of events, and your heart just broke for him. It really did. It really impacted the game too, because you could tell even the opposition team, Oklahoma, were, God, we want to win, but not like this, you know? So, look, congratulations to Oklahoma City Thunder, and Indiana did a fantastic job to stay in the game for as long as they did.
Okay, well, there we go. Well, look, again, other stories that are happening in our region. I believe we go to Fiji for this one. This is... There's a family of an Australian man seeking answers after he died while working at a hotel in Fiji in December last year. Gosh, what are they saying?
Yeah, that's right. So the man who died was 40-year-old Jason Rigby, who was working as acting manager of Crown Plaza in Nandi when he was found in the bathroom of a suite with stab wounds in his chest back in December. He was declared dead at the scene, with his girlfriend and colleague both stating it was an apparent suicide. Police later confirmed that and declared the case closed. However, Mr. Rigby's family have told 60 Minutes that they believe that foul play was involved. They've actually now employed a private investigator all the way from over in the UK to look into the case to see what new information they can dig up.
Do we know, though, if the Fiji police have made a statement?
Absolutely, they have. They've doubled down on their initial assessment, insisting there was no indication of any foul play. However, the case will now go to a coronial inquest. The family obviously believes there's more to this story, and apparently the PI has uncovered some new information by way of thousands of messages on Mr. Rigby's iCloud, which could be relevant, who knows. And for what it's worth, according to forensic pathologists, suicide by stabbing is very rare.
Okay, wow, that's very unfortunate to hear, though. But look, meanwhile, there seems to be 10 unsolved cases set to be reopened in Vanuatu, is that right?
That's right. So they'll be re-examined, reinvestigated, and re-prosecuted under a sweeping new reform plan launched by Vanuatu's new police commissioner. So this will be done by a new high-profile case review task force and comes as part of a 100-day plan to completely revamp the police force in Vanuatu. It's being called one of the most ambitious reform efforts in the history of the VPF, in fact. And the commissioner says the plan will confront some hard truths that exist within the force at the moment. It will end internal divisions, restore the chain of command, and reclaim the honour of the badge. A task force will also be established to investigate absenteeism, abuse of power, and unethical behaviour within the ranks, and surprise inspections will also be implemented across police precincts. So new commissioner's entered the scene, and he's well and truly brought the whip with him.
A bit of a crackdown, yes. Okay, now look, yesterday we reported about a break-in at the Fiji Prime Minister's house. However, another strange report came out of Mr. Rumbuka's inner circle late last week, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So Fiji's police confirmed an investigation is underway involving a member of his security detail. It's alleged the person actually eloped with an official of Mr. Rumbuka's office about 2 weeks ago. But it's not as romantic as it might sound, I should say. Both individuals involved are reportedly married to other people. And there's also been reports that the pair absconded with government-issued electronic devices. However, the police commissioner has rejected those claims since. So, look, regardless of what the situation is, it sounds like there's a bit of gossip that's taking place around the PM's office at the moment, I imagine.
I feel like Fiji can't catch a break at the moment, but my goodness. Well, as always, Kyle, I just want to say Malo Bito for bringing a news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
Thank you, Aggie.
Join me, Melissa Macon, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference. Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday from 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Noa Ia e Māori, welcome back to Pacific Beat. We turn our attention to sport now. In rugby league, the PNG Hunters are licking their wounds after their third loss in as many weeks in the Queensland Cup. The side went down 36-16 to the Tigers in Brisbane. However, at the NRL level, things are looking up for one of PNG's bright young stars. Zach Labert has made a successful return from an ACL injury and re-cemented himself in the North Queensland Cowboys run-on squad. Now he's got his sights set on international footy, where he hopes to make up for lost time with the Kumuls following the NRL season.
I'm obviously very devastated last year that I had this injury, and that was something that was big playing on my mind, not being able to represent the Kumuls and play with my brother again. Hopefully I can get that opportunity again this year.
You got Robert Darby as well beside you each week in the Cowboys, who's another PNG Kumul. I'm guessing, yeah, you guys have chatted about that a bit and that passion.
Yeah, buddy. He's always chatting about the postseason antics and what we can toss up together as a team for PNG. So I'm very excited and hopefully get another crack at it.
Yeah, well, when you did, you got to play in PNG in Port Moresby, which I'm sure was extra special. The sport is literally a religion in the country. What did you make of, you know, your time there, getting to know the people and the culture?
Yeah, that was... I actually went there for a Queensland Cup game a few weeks earlier, and that was my first opportunity. And then to be on the opposite side of the crowd probably wasn't the nicest thing, because you can't hear your own teammates. But when I ran out there with the crowd behind my back, made the hair on the back of my neck stand up. It was honestly surreal, the way they cheer, and it feels like a 100,000-person stadium out there at Santos Stadium. So I'm very excited to be back in PNG, and hopefully we get a few more home games there.
Yeah, it is crazy how much it means to people there. So what do you think a PNG NRL team is going to look like? You know, how hard is it going to be for opposition teams to go to Port Moresby and try and take on the team, but also the crowd?
Yeah, it's obviously a different beast. As I said, I've played a bit of cup up here, and so going up there for cups, hard enough as it is, it's a hard side to be in cups. I can only imagine what a force they're going to be in the NRL. So I'm looking forward to how that team shapes up, and looking forward to the future of rugby league and PNG.
Tell us a player, I don't know, maybe someone who plays overseas or for the Hunters that you might have played with alongside in the Kumuls, who people may not know but you think will be well suited to playing in the NRL, maybe for that team or maybe otherwise.
Well done to put me on the spot. you obviously got the big players that play in the Super League. There's a few of them now in the Super League, so I think someone like Lockie Lamb for one of these expansion teams can come back and really dominate in the halves. And I think Jordan Rimbu actually just went back to PNG from the Super League. So I think any of those sort of players, even Edwin Apape, there's a few of them that, these expansion teams coming in, they could really come back and dominate.
There we go. Put you on the spot. You come up with three great names. Love that. All right, let's talk about 2024, Zach. It was a big challenge for you. How frustrating was it that you were just sort of getting some consistency, and then how tough was that road back from the ACL injury?
As you said, I was getting a bit of consistency in my game, and, it's obviously a season-ending injury, and it was very devastating, but I had a great team around me up in Townsville, and not only at the Cowboys, but at home through my partner, my family, and that sort of thing. So it was very frustrating, but I'm grateful to be back now and in this side, and again building on that consistency and just trying to play my best footy each week.
And that's North Queensland Cowboys and Kumuls centre Zach Labatt, and he was speaking with ABC's Declan Byrne.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics, and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions, like why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk. Tuesday, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Tā aloha ni, you're tuning into Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie the Bowl. Well, the pristine islands and crystal clear waters of Raja Ampat in Indonesia's Papua province are often described as paradise on earth. It's a dream spot for tourists and divers from around the world. But last week, Raja Ampat was trending for all the wrong reasons. The hashtag Save Raja Ampat went viral, and suddenly the spotlight was on this remote region for an entirely different reason. To find out what's going on, we're joined by Erwin Vrenaldi from ABC Indonesia. With that, I say good morning, Erwin.
Good morning, Aggie. How are you today?
I am good. Thank you so much for joining us. I mean, what exactly happened in Raja Ampat, Erwin? You know, that got everyone talking and sharing those viral hashtags and photos.
Yes. Like you mentioned, Aggie, Raja Ampat in Papua is a stunning island, and they have a gorgeous reefs underwater Early this month, the Greenpeace Indonesia and many activists, environmental activists, they released videos and photos showing nickel mining activities, clearing forests, and also dumping sediment waste into coastal waters. And the images really showing the different color of the sea, which is the changing of the sea that you mentioned before. It was crystal clear, but it becoming like a little bit polluted. And also some locals and also tourists, they began posting powerful images and videos of the damaged island, and suddenly the hashtag Save Raja Ampat were everywhere, spreading like wildfire, I would say, Aggie, on social media, because from our observation, at least one dramatic post alone can be viewed over 15 million views on Instagram.
Wow.
And yeah, it was very, very went viral for the wrong reason.
But Erwin, this is something that obviously has not just happened last week because of these, you know, hashtags and photos that have been uploaded on online. Is this something that has just been going on for quite a while?
Well, the Indonesian government said that there are at least five mining companies that were operating in that area, and it is been quite a while, but very fortunate because it hasn't been really like in other island of Indonesia, which is the nickel mining has been fully operated there. In Raja Ampat, is still in the beginning phase. So when the environmental activists and the local and tourists found out and putting the photos and videos online and then went viral, then the government revoked four of the mining companies. But the problem is one mining company, the major one, it still exists. And this is still until today becoming like a concern for the local people and also the environmentalists in Raja Ampat, especially for those who are working in conservation.
Mm. And yes, as you said, it sounds like they've made a good step with the Indonesian government stepping in and revoking some of those mining permits. But you have spoken, though, with local indigenous Papuans, right, and conservationists based in the Raja Ampat. What did they actually share with you about how this is affecting them?
Yeah, Aggie, that's a very good question, because initially when the hashtag went viral, people think that, oh, this is, you know, like a lot of people only concerned because this is a tourist spot, right? But then for local indigenous Papuans and for scientists and people who are doing conservation in Raja Ampat, including one from Australia, saying that this is not only a tourist spot, but this is also a livelihood, because the fishing from Raja Ampat feeds their families, and also the land holds cultural stories and also cultural identity. And one of them also like saying when they see the forests disappear and also like the reefs, for example, grow cloudy and the fish disappear, the future is sinking. So the conservationists also echoed this and then pointing out how mining may clear hundreds of hectares of the coral reefs and also removing the fish. So it's very, very important that this is not only about a spot for tourists, but also this is the livelihood for indigenous Papuans there.
And Erwin, look, I wonder if you could just maybe expand a little bit, because yes, we know Indonesia is the biggest refiner of nickel in the world, right? There's been research showing that arsenic has actually been found in some of those fish. I believe that there were blood samples taken from residents living near that area that recorded quite a heavy presence of metals, which levels exceeding safe thresholds like in at least 15 people. So what have the people been saying about how to keep themselves safe from such a, do you know, like this is becoming more prevalent now?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, the water samples from the main river, this is not from Raja Ampat, but from the nearby island. It's saying that, which is served as a drinking sources, it has a concentration of heavy metals. and also blood samples taken also recorded a presence of heavy metals like mercury and also arsenic. And it's now really making like the fish also like taken from the mining site, which is also being sold at the market in the nearby island, becoming very harmful because of the ingredients, like the nickel that is found in the fish. So now the government really needs to really take care of the local families, and including like providing on-site clinic to make sure that everyone's get tested. And also one of the program that that might been done by the activists is also making sure that everyone's get their fish and also water from a safer places or safer sources.
Look, Erwin, thank you so much for keeping us across as to what is happening there in Raja Ampat, but we appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
No worries. That is Erwin Renardi from ABC Indonesia here on Pacific Beat.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, the Tonga Trench is 2,550 kilometres long and reaches depths of over 10,000 metres. It's the second deepest oceanic trench in the world. Its extreme depths have fostered a remote ecosystem, home to rarely seen marine life, such as deep sea sharks, crustaceans and aquatic plants. Alan Jameson, a professor and deep sea scientist at the University of Western Australia, has explored the Tonga Trench extensively. He says apart from the marine life, there have been surprising finds. Everything from volcanic ash waste deposited from the Hunga Tonga Hunga Hapai eruption to everyday rubbish. Whenau Whenua spoke with Alan Jameson.
I personally went to the deepest point, which is the second deepest place on Earth. We did a four-hour dive to 10,800 metres, and we did one to 10,000. It's incredible. It's a very unique area as well, because some of these trenches are very, very deep, but they're all different in their own way. And so the Tonga Trench, for example, the very deepest point, when you get down beyond sort of 9, 10 kilometres, it's all very grey and featureless, and that's because of all the volcanic activity. So you remember a few years ago, that big volcano went off. All the ash has to go somewhere. All the ash will end up in the sea, and it will sink. So, yeah, it makes kind of sense. You get down to the very bottom and realize that everything's kind of grey looking, and there are plenty of animals and plenty of species that survive every single depth, even at the very deepest point in Tonga Trench, where we're still seeing animals swimming around. It's very unique. It's a beautiful place.
That's very interesting. I covered the eruption. So a lot of the ash actually went into the trench. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. So we had this peculiar dive where we've done dives to 10,000 metres before, in Mariana Trench, in places like the Philippine Trench. And normally the sea floor is a kind of golden brown colour. You see lots of tracks and burrows and signs that things have been there. And then you see sea cucumbers and scale worms and all these different species, right? But in Tonga, we went down, and as soon as we got to the seafloor, it's like, ooh, weird. There was no tracks, no burrows, not as many species as you would expect based on other places. But what really got us is how fragile the seafloor was. You know, when you're moving around in a submarine, you create these little eddies and little bow waves and stuff. And we kept seeing these little sort of really small avalanches. Like, you would just get too close to the seafloor and the seafloor would like fall away from you. And it wasn't us blowing it away. It was collapsing and sliding down a slope. And at the time, we're kind of like, wow, this is like super fragile. And it wasn't until afterwards we started thinking about it. Why is that? You know, normally deep sea mud's really sticky. And it shouldn't do that. And then we realized, of course, the reason why it's a kind of gray color, the reason why there's no tracks and burrows is because it's all new material. It's all ash that's come down. And it's just this fine veneer of ash that if you go anywhere near it, it just slips down the slope and runs off like a little avalanche. So it was a really interesting time to be poking around in the deepest places.
And that must be testament to how powerful that eruption. Did it affect the life down there?
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize that the deep sea is subjected to everything that happens on the surface. So even if you have a jellyfish bloom or a spring bloom on the surface, with all that stuff eventually will die and it will sink and it'll end up in the deep sea. Likewise, all that plastic and all the rubbish and chemicals that go into the sea, just because they leave the surface and we can't see them anymore, doesn't mean to say that they've disappeared. Where they're going is the deep sea. So we rarely do a dive at the extreme depths of the world without seeing at least one piece of human waste. which is quite sad. But, you know, the deep sea is not a magic portal to another dimension. You know, anything that's floating around that shouldn't be there will sink. Plus, you know, everything from fish and squid and dolphins and whales and everything that is alive and we're happy about and we enjoy on the surface, they all die. And if they're sitting over deep water, they'll end up in the deep sea.
Even at that depth, you found the rubbish.
Some trenches we found, some of the ones off Japan, we found a huge amount. Philippines was really bad. Philippines was plastic bags everywhere, even at 10,000 meters, which is plastic bags of every color. You can even read the logo and stuff off the side of them. It was ridiculous. And we did a campaign earlier, before Tonga last year, at a place called Nova Canton, which is about 4 days north of Samoa, right on the equator. There's a really big deep trench up there. It's about 8,000 meters deep. And we were driving along the seafloor and we saw this thing on the seafloor and we thought, oh, we better go and film that. And we went over to it and it was just a box of Chinese cigarettes, which is just peculiar. You know, it's like someone had just dropped them 10 minutes ago, you know, and it's just lying at, you know, whatever it was, 7,500 meters on the equator, thousands of miles away from anywhere. And so, yeah, these surface currents can take garbage from anywhere and eventually it will get deposited anywhere. When you can see the plastic, it's probably okay. It's when it's the stuff you cannot see is quite worrying. So we did our analysis about chemical contamination a few years back, and we found that places like the bottom of the Mariana Trench have got huge amounts of organic pollutants in there, which are man-made. And so all these things that, you know, get pumped into river systems and pumped off of beaches and stuff, they go out to sea and eventually disperse, and people will take samples and declare that it's all kind of being diluted down and it's no longer a threat. But what it's doing is it's sinking. And so the problem there with the stuff you can't see is you're not quite sure what it's doing, because we cannot study these animals alive. You can't bring them back to laboratory and try and work out what are these chemicals doing to this animal.
How important is it for you to get into submarines and visit these deep, for scientists to go to these places and document what's happening there?
Yeah, I think we're playing a game of catch-up, because like I said before, we know that we're having adverse effects on the surface, right? That's not news to anyone, right? The world is changing. There's atmospheric heating, there's pollutants, there's stuff that shouldn't be there, there's shipwrecks, there's all this kind of stuff. And we know about it on the surface, but the deep sea, most of planet Earth is deep sea. And this is the weird one. So there's two different thoughts. There are people who only really care about an environment if it has a day-to-day benefit to them. So that's this sort of anthropocentric opinion on it. If it doesn't affect me personally, I don't care. And this is where you get this out of sight, out of mind mentality. Where there's others that think, no, the entire planet is one big living ecosystem. You can't just ignore a bit of it. And now, if you think about 70% of planet Earth is deep sea, and if you take an average from the top of Mount Everest to the bottom of the Mariana Trench, planet Earth is about 4,000 meters deeper on average, right? So most of planet Earth is deep sea. So that, to then think, that's not that important, is it? It's not maybe important to the average human being in their day-to-day lives, but in terms of stewardship of this planet that we live on, I think it's important that we document everything as to where it lives, what it does. And then you can start thinking about what happens if we, you know, what happens if we accidentally remove one of these species, or what happens if we pollute this environment? Because a good example was when the Deepwater Horizon disaster, when there was suddenly there's huge amounts of oil, completely and utterly man-made, in very deep water. It was over 1,000 meters. And everyone was like, oh, what kind of effect is this going to have on the environment? And the answer was, we don't know, because no one's ever given us any money to explore it. You only get money retrospectively when something bad happens, but then the baseline data isn't there anymore. And so that was a good example of when, you know, thinking that it didn't matter because it was deep sea. And so all we're trying to do is work out how the world works and hopefully get people, you know, really into it, because I think there's a great science aside, people love natural history.
And that's Alan Jameson, a professor and deep sea scientist at the University of Western Australia. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Recapping our top story, Guam Governor Lou Leon Guerrero has assured residents they are safe after their island was used as a decoy for the US attack on Iran. However, Guam advocates fear their island is nothing more than a pawn for the military.
And that's really the next step, the capacity to say no, the capacity to say, and we're not going to accept the scenario in which our only role is to attack others.
and that's former Guam delegate to the United States House of Representatives, current chair of the Pacific Centre for Island Security, Robert Underwood. Well, I'll be back same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because news is next. And coming after that, I believe Nita Daly is tuning in from Samoa. Until next time, o tua whātou, this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
Join me, Melissa Makin, for Nita Daly, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference.
Search up ABC Nita Daly Afternoon Edition to listen online or find it in the ABC Listen app.